Hello, and welcome to the Hire Someone to Rob You episode of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios. I'm here with Emily Peck of Fundrise.
Hello.
I'm here with Stacey Marie Ishmael of Bloomberg.
Hello.
And guys, we have an incredibly special guest this week, Teresa Ghiaducci. Welcome.
Hello. Hi.
Introduce yourself. Who are you? Where are you?
I'm a professor of economics at the New School for Social Research in Manhattan.
So, Teresa, we have an unbelievably fun and wonky and awesome episode coming up with you. We are basically going to be talking about retirement, which is a subject that we get a lot of questions about and we very rarely have answers to. So you're going to provide the answers. We're going to talk about who's retiring, who's saving, how they're saving, how we can fix the system, why the system is broken, why everyone should be living in a co-op, why it's good to own your neighbor's toilet. We even have a Slate Plus segment on Logan Roy and his retirement plan. It's all coming up on Slate Money.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So, Teresa, welcome. You are an expert on all things retirement.
Right. And also wealth. You know, it sounds a little narrow to be just on retirement. It really is about wealth. And when you talk about wealth that workers have, it's really about worker power. I just get at that through retirement.
So basically, if I'm working and I'm building up my wealth, that means I'm getting more powerful. And if my wealth is going down, that means I'm becoming less powerful.
A lot like that. Now, you may not be powerful. Well, you're probably powerful in a lot of places at home, but mainly at your workplace. And that's the whole point. I mean, if workers have wealth or security, because a lot of people just want insurance, not wealth. And the way in America that we backstop the risk that we will get tossed out in the labor force or we'll live too long, is with wealth, but in most other nations, it's with just social insurance. But if you have that, the wealth or the insurance, not only do you have a dignified way to think about your life, like I work really hard now and then I'm going to have the reward at the end of my life to control the pace and content of my time, but you also have some ability towards, you know, in your late 50s or your late 60s to kind of shape the kind of work you want. You can tell the employer, you know, that this is what I want, because if you're tossed out, it doesn't matter as much. And if you're not in that situation, you have a whole precariat of older workers. And in most nations, that group is getting larger, like tens of millions of them. Then you have employers have a group of workers on their hands that really are more malleable. So retirement wealth, you know, is a personal finance issue, but it's also a real big macro issue.
And then the big macro thing that has happened over the past year or two is we've had this great resignation, the great retirement. We've had a whole bunch of older workers leave the workforce and not come back. We've had every survey of consumer finances from the Fed and everyone else has been showing that people are richer than they've ever been, especially poor people are richer than they've ever been. Is this like the silver lining of the pandemic? It just made everyone richer? It's a good thing?
No, you know what? No, it really depends upon who you are. I call it just the tale of two retirements, you know, the tale of two big resignations, the tale of two, you know, wealth buckets. So people who are older, like in their 65 to 70, those Americans are retiring in all the true sense of the word. It sounds like they're making the decision, and they're probably making the decision. We've asked them, but we also can see how the buildup of their wealth, they're doing it voluntarily. So the great resignation, you know, is happening among older workers, like over 65, who have wealth and more wealth than they ever imagined. You know, the stock market's gone up you know, double digits and the first digit isn't one. But the other tail of retirement, so-called retirement, is not a worker's choice at all. It is mostly among older workers. So this is 57 to like 65. They don't have college degrees. They are retiring. They're telling surveyors that they're retired, but in fact, they've been pushed out of the labor market. And we know that because they haven't gotten wealthy. And the only way that the poor are wealthier than they ever have is because some of that stimulus money may have helped them pay down some debt. But in terms of any kind of wealth, you know, as a backstop for any of their life choices or for these big disruptions, it's mainly because they've paid down some debt.
Could I ask you, going back to what you said before about the U.S. not really having social insurance? I mean, we do have Social Security for when you retire. Is that just so insufficient that so is
Yeah, no, we do have social insurance in Social Security and Medicare. And it's wonderful. And I celebrate it, you know, rah, rah, I'll do it right here. but in terms of the rest of the nation, it provides the least in terms of replacement rate. So a middle-class worker under Social Security would only get about 35% of their pre-retirement earnings. In other countries, what comes from social insurance is much larger. And other countries even do it smarter. They have social insurance and then semi-social insurance kind of built on top of that. So let's talk about the Danes, you know, even though they're off on another planet, but it could be even the Netherlands. And even some parts, big parts of France and even England, where you have kind of a mandated social insurance, that layer, that tiramisu layer of social insurance. And on top of that, a mandated or nearly mandated pension plan where everybody has to contribute to their pension plan. And then it grows. And then at the end of their work lives, they can take it out as an annuity. This is really, like, really easy. All you have to do is put money in early, have it not be stolen or badly managed, and not have fees, high fees, you know, take the money away from it, you know, degrade its value. Keep it there until you're retired, and then take it out and have it last the rest of your life. And in America, we don't have a system that does that for people.
That's harder, though, in a very low interest rate environment, right? Like an annuity is something where you take a lump sum of money and you convert it into an income. And when interest rates are super low, the income you get from a lump sum of money is kind of tiny. And you're like thinking to yourself, why did I even bother?
Yeah. No, so people, we have really good systems in America too. We don't even have to look to Denmark or the Netherlands. You can look to the United Auto Workers, you know, or to janitors who are in SEIU locals, who are the building managers who are cleaning up your commercial buildings, or our doormen, you know, who are in the 32BJ. They have a pension system, Social Security, and then on top of that, they have a defined benefit system. That money is put in and managed professionally by managers, and they have a little bit of Blackstone, a little bit of Brazilian Timberland. They have stocks, they have bonds, they have a diversified assets, and they don't have to really look at just a retail available interest rate. They can have a diverse portfolio. Now they may not get 7 or 8 like you could before, but they're getting 5. And so if we all put in 5% of our pay from the beginning of our work lives, like these janitors do, have it accumulate at 5%, you know, for the rest of your lives, you add that to Social Security, you actually have maintained your middle class lifestyle. So that's actually not that hard.
When you're saying that, like, the janitors are getting 5%, what does that mean?
You have two janitors. One is in Ohio and doesn't have a union, and the other one is in New York and does. So the one in Ohio has the 401k type plan. The one in New York has a DB plan. So they have to save $1 every week for their retirement plan. The janitor without a DC plan, they're on their own. They just invest. They will have to go to retail managers at high fees, and they have to rely on their own their own investment advice, which is usually to put it in a safe asset or to put it all in stocks or whatever their brother-in-law says to do. But they manage their own money. Over time, they are going to earn a lot less on that continually dollar contribution than the janitor who is in a DB plan and has to sacrifice a dollar of his wages, that's according to his union contract, that goes into a defined benefit plan. So their whole work life, let's say 35 years, the one who is on their own and contributing to a 401k got a much lower rate of return than the janitor in a DB plan. So then the game ends and they both retire. The janitor who was always in a 401k plan has a much smaller accrual than the janitor in the DB plan.
But they both have a lump sum.
But they both have a lump sum, but the one that had it in a DB plan has much, much higher.
Okay, so that's the bit which I didn't understand. I didn't realize that you had defined benefit plans that paid out a defined benefit that was some lump sum rather than a defined benefit that was some ongoing income.
I'm just a little confused because, and maybe this is because I've conflated defined benefit plans with pensions, which I thought basically guaranteed a retiree a fixed income until he or she died.
Yeah,
which sounds
right.
like different right. from what you were describing, which sounds like you just draw down from a lump sum.
So the DB plan does give you an annuity for life. A DC plan could also give you an annuity for life. So what's crucial is like how much money do you have to convert into an annuity? A DB plan does it automatically, but it has a lot more money to do it with for lots of reasons that Felix was just saying. But the DC plan just has less money. That's the simplest thing, that if you have $1 that you're saving, you'd much rather do it in a diverse plan with long-term, short-term assets, with a manager who could bargain down the fees, you know, and has a much longer time horizon.
But Teresa, why do you even care? If you're in a DB plan and you are getting guaranteed a certain salary for life, why do you care what the returns were in the pension plan when you're going to be getting that salary no matter what the returns were?
Yeah. Because in the end, the employer reduces the wages according to how much money they have to put into the pension plan. So you're the United Auto Workers, you're bargaining for the United Auto Workers. The auto workers want $100, you know, per month extra. The employer says, okay, how much is that going to cost me? If the pension plan is really well managed, like they are, then they don't have to take so much out of the workers' wages. If the pension plan was not well managed, then they would have to actually contribute a lot from the workers' wages. So essentially, the incidence is on the worker. The worker has to pay no matter what. So you care a lot, and you can see lots of unions wanting to have a say in the way their pension plans are managed, really fuss about the private equity managers that might be in it that don't really yield anything. They've pushed for legislation, so there's no conflict of interest. So you care a lot, you know, what your rate of return is, even if it's an indirect benefit. If you're represented by a union, you know that what the pension plan earns will redound back to you in higher wages.
I feel like as a person who started in and for years and years didn't have access to a 401k, for example, or to, you know, when I the brief window that I worked in the UK, I joined right when they were like, nope, no more pensions for anyone. What is the kind of percentage of American workers or workers in the US who even have access to these kinds of options?
Half of workers right now have access to a pension plan at work. So in Denmark and almost every other country, you are automatically put into, you're not nudged, you're shoved, you know, into a pension plan that earns a pretty good high rate of return. You can't take it out to remodel your kitchen. You can't take it out, you know, for the kind of emergencies that happen. You have to keep it in, just like we have to keep our Social Security in. And at the end of their working lives, they have enough money to replace what they had earned. The Americans are the only ones that are asked to save for the long term in short term instruments. It's totally mismatched and really the unintended consequences of an unthought out system. It makes no financial sense at all. So our system does not let ordinary people invest in the things that union workers have or wealthy people have. A well-balanced, diversified portfolio.
Are the assets that I can invest in through my 401k just much more limited than what I could get if I had a defined benefit? And what kind of assets are those? Because like I don't want to invest in a hedge fund, Teresa, I don't think.
Yes, you do. You do. So I'm a trustee of a $60 billion fund. Our liabilities are the United Auto Workers, retirees, healthcare. We earn more money than we pay out in benefits because we have a little bit of a hedge fund. We have 23 people managing it. We have a little bit of a hedge fund, a little bit of a lot of private equity, but only the best. We have access to the best managers because we're so large. They come to us because there's some prestige in having a big fund. So big, well-managed funds that are diversified have much better returns and lower fees. But you, Emily, and me on our own do not want to own a hedge fund because you won't get the good ones. We are left with the bottom feeders, we retailers. You know, every New Yorker knows that you want to buy wholesale, not retail. And poor 401k participants were only stuck with retail.
How much of the advantage of defined benefit plans is a function of what you're talking about in terms of they get to invest with Sequoia or whoever, and they get higher returns? And how much of it is a function of what I was mentioning earlier, which is the sort of actuarial cross-subsidy where the people who die earlier effectively wind up subsidizing the people who live longer?
Yeah, it's called the longevity credit. It's probably 80% asset allocation, and the rest longevity credits, and also fees and scale. So you know the scale economies and the longevity credits, but most of it, it's probably 85%, is asset allocation. I mean, you've heard this before. It's really important to pick your contribution levels, but it's much more important to figure out what your asset allocation is.
Really? Like, I've always written the exact opposite. Maybe I've been wrong the whole time.
Well, yeah, just mathematics. Because if you can get another 1%, you know, risk adjusted and fee adjusted, that can be the same as adding 2% more contribution rate. I know all I've done it is brute force. I don't know how to invest, even though I'm a PhD economist, it's really hard as an individual. So I just put a lot of money into it and close my eyes, which is what most of us do. Or we go to the barbell. We say, oh, I'm a risky. I believe in the stock market because you were in a good mood that day and you went all in. People who retired in the 70s who did all that retired on half of what they could live on than somebody who retired, you know, in right before the crash in 2009. I mean, so our system not only hurts people because they don't know how to invest, they get lousy rates of return, but they can't change the time that they have to retire. And so if you retire in a good market, you're lucky. If you retire in a bad market, you're not. Even though we're supposed to have a system that kind of rewards people for the same kind of behavior. I mean, if you're a saver like an ant, you're supposed to like be rewarded like an ant. If you're a grasshopper, you know, and you don't, you know, then maybe you won't. That's the kind of justice in these system. But one that just has to do with timing of the market through no fault of your own is really a broken down system. And it's really unequal.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance. Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
I feel like we talk a lot about things that are fundamentally very depressing on this podcast, but this is like exceptionally depressing. So just to bring the tone down even further, what is someone supposed to do, right? If they're part of that 50%, they don't have access to either DC or DB. They don't necessarily have access to liquid assets either. Like which sounds to me just that there's like a tremendous amount of policy failure here. What do you tell people to do?
One is to really vote. The government is your most important financial partner. And politicians that say they're going to preserve your Social Security and your Medicare and maybe lower the Medicare age, are really important financial managers. So make sure that those programs are in state. And I'm not kidding. You know, it's a really important part of your financial management is to pay attention to those programs. But second, if you are a gig worker or intermittent worker and you don't have access to those workplace plans, then an individual retirement account with Vanguard, and I'll tell you why Vanguard, is your next best option. And you want to save, depending upon your age, 5 to 10%. If you're young, more 5. If you're older, you need to save 10. And the reason why I say Vanguard is because it's the only money manager that has a fiduciary responsibility to you, the saver. Nobody else does. And it's because of their ownership structure that every owner, every account manager is an owner. So a corporate has a responsibility to you as a shareholder, and that's a fiduciary responsibility. And they don't have a responsibility to any other shareholder, so they don't have to extract profits from you.
America's done a very good job of moving to Vanguard. You know, they have this total market fund with $1.3 trillion in it. The passive investment gospel, I feel like I've been writing about this quite a bit, but we Gen Xers have completely bought into this, right? We, like, the people of, like, Emily and my generation who have been understanding why low fees are good and all of this kind of thing. I think that's actually one of the reasons why Emily and I are probably a little bit reluctant to buy into your tale of like, oh yeah, you should put more money into 2 and 20 private illiquids.
I was really
because
surprised
like, well,
by
2 and 20, that's like crazy. Like, no, we want Vanguard with 4 basis points. That's part of it. But I am also, especially post pandemic, looking at a whole new generation of investors, you know, in crypto, on Reddit, who have learned that stocks only ever go up, who are making astonishing returns, who are young enough to be able to afford to take substantial losses if and when that ever happens, and who are not like outsourcing their retirement plans to a Vanguard 2055 target, but taking control, learning about investing, and becoming much more financially sophisticated than any of us lot were at that age. And half of me shudders because I'm like, you can't do that. You have no idea what you're doing. And then another half of me goes, well, you've made a lot of money and you seem to be learning a lot. Is it really that bad?
Yeah, it's that bad. They're making a lot of money now. But there's two things. for everybody else who isn't in a professional plan and a big one and one that's well maintained, Vanguard 60/40 or a target date fund is exactly the right thing to do. It's actually what the federal government employees are in. They even have even better funds. It's a fiduciary, really low fees. It's the federal government, 6 million of them in that. But if I didn't have a professional manager, I'd be in Vanguard. In fact, when I have a choice, I'm always in Vanguard. So 60/40. But I'm a trustee of the $60 billion fund, and we benchmark what we get according to what we could get in Vanguard. Every quarter, I make us do that exercise. And it's close, but we always get a little bit more, and that means we can add in dental and vision. You know, we could actually spend more money that way. So it adds in the little luxuries. The difference can matter. Yeah,
but Teresa, just think of all of the billions of dollars you're giving to Sand Hill Road, and they're driving up the property prices in San Francisco to the point at which people just, the cost of living goes up.
Well, there is another issue about the complexities of capitalism. We should, and the way that we invest our money is actually hurting our communities and our livelihoods. But that would be another subject. If now I'm just talking about how you get your maximum rate of return as a little individual with none access to these conservatives, do two things. In your individual retirement account, save a lot, put it in Vanguard, and put it in a fund according to your age. The second thing you do if you're in a 401k is absolutely insist that they have passive choices. Because right now you can have a 401k with all sorts of words naming your mutual funds, growth, this, that, and you can't even tell if it's a stock or a bond fund. And it's usually garbage. And now we're seeing lots of lawsuits about the garbagey stuff that these employers put in the 401k, because they outsource it to consultants. The MIT 401k type plan was filled with a bunch of products from Fidelity, because Fidelity was on their board at MIT. So the universities have just been ravaged by this.
I'm fascinated by this whole syndrome of 401k plans being chosen by some random person in HR who was never really qualified to pick a 401k plan on the basis of basically the sales technique of these large companies and the ones with the most persuasive sales techniques, and also I think the ones with the most recognizable brand names are the ones that wind up tending to get chosen. In the back of my head, I've always had this idea that there's some kind of implicit or explicit like kickback, that the 401k providers somehow pay the companies to choose them rather than someone else. But does that not happen?
It happens all the time, and your only recourse is to sue. So they're suing. There's a case going up to the Supreme Court. Absolutely. There is no, as long as you went through a process and interviewed people and they gave you a good, they gave you a good consulting. I've seen this evolve. And the big part of their services is to say, and we'll fold the administration fee and make your workers pay for it. then they get chosen. And it is somehow just malfeasance, just some random person in HR picking, or it's a personal friend and some kickbacks, which would be illegal, but most of them are indirect, and they're just kind of professional relationships with people at your club. It's not well run, and it's very particularly American, the lack of oversight. And the result of this is that people who have higher income and do investments, they'll go out and hire a financial advisor. So the American system requires you to go find a financial advisor. Most of us might get the advisors in the tech, in the phone, you know, on Google, or you have worse. The worst are the ones recommended to you by family and friends. They're the worst. You get one of those, and you get told to be put into a lot of high fee funds. the very the wealthy of us go to a non-conflicted advisor and go to them like you would go a therapist, you know, or a specialist, and say, "I'll pay you $1,000. Here's my life. Recommend what I should do." And that person doesn't get any financial benefit from what they recommend from you. That's what the very wealthy and sophisticated do, and they get much higher returns. So the system is built that if you want to do it well, you have to go extracurricular. If you really want to do it well, you have to go extracurricular, find your own advisor, and get one that's not conflicted. And they really only exist in concentrated areas. So if you're in the suburbs or in a rural area, you don't even have a chance to win at this.
The government is subsidizing the rich enormously here. Like, if you are someone with enough liquidity to be able to sock away $17,000 a year in your 401k, then the government will let you do that all tax-free. But if you are a normal person who does not have $17,000 a year to sock away into a 401k, then all of those tax benefits just go to the rich, and you wind up with a much smaller or possibly zero tax benefit. And it always astonishes me when I see the numbers of, like, the tax expenditure, it's called, of the 401k program. Just how much money the government spends on the 401k program, and the way that that money is skewed overwhelmingly to the top quintile of the population.
So we know that the rich get tax breaks on all sorts of things that nobody else does, like the mortgage interest deduction, short-term capital or long-term capital gains tax. We all know that the rich do better, but the retirement benefit is the most unfair. 70% of that total $250 billion goes to the top 20%. And these, we know behaviorally as economists, that these are people that would save anyway for retirement.
Yeah, they
don't need it to save. They don't need to meet the public interest that we want. They also have enough. How much they have to save, then they'll spend it later, will not hurt their lifestyle. But they get over $7,000 a year for saving the maximum. But somebody who makes $17,000 or $20,000, like the maximum they can put in, depending on your age, they could be just as virtuous, you know, as the rich person. Put away money, find Vanguard, but they'll get nothing from the government.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fracturing me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
I want to talk more about gender as an explanatory variable, right? Because is it indeed true that women who live longer but also make less money and are in a lot of cases disadvantaged by the tax code are up against an even worse set of conditions, even though, you know, according to the behavioral studies, they are more likely to make so-called good investments and savings decisions?
They're also disadvantaged because they have kids and husbands.
Ah, those husbands.
Both both really hurt accumulation. I was working with an anthropologist, and we did focus groups with low-income women, asking about their retirement and asking about their financial security and their financial future. And we really we did this in a very positive way, but they really wanted more Social Security. And the reason is because their husbands and kids couldn't get it. And so what happens, this goes back to bargaining power, you have a couple retiring in their early 60s, and you have a difference of opinion about how fast the money should be spent. So there is some evidence that the one who will not live as long wants to live it up, go on trips, and it could not, and it's not always conflictual. It's a joyful idea, you know, that we could do all these things together, but it doesn't take into account what the wife will need at 80. So a woman's subordinate bargaining power and her assignment of being caring her children and her husband puts her at a disadvantage for wealth accumulating and making it last. And then you add in their low wages, and then that hurts. What helps women is that they tend not to think that Dogecoin or any other risky investment is something they should be in. They're more safe, and they are a little more suspicious of advisors. You know, so there is they really just assume they're getting ripped off. Now that could hurt them because their assets are really too safe. You know, really maybe tucked in their checking accounts. But they don't trade it, and they also don't trade as often. So there are gender differences. Most of them hurt women.
So let me ask you about this, the mother of all trade-offs here. And this is the big one that really overarches this entire conversation, is do I spend the money today or do I save it for some hypothetical future point?
Which may have higher inflation now.
I was just going to ask that. It's like a big existential question that I think about a lot. It's like, I want to spend my money while I'm still alive. Like, isn't retirement this scam perpetuated by, like, just another Charles Schwab survey that is sent to me, you know, like just another press release from a finance company telling me how unprepared I am?
It is like such an existential question that John Maynard Keynes addressed it in a book he called The General Theory. So the general theory is about how societies decide, whether governments or people decide to spend now or save later. And it is the most philosophical of questions, because you have to believe in your own future and the future of these institutions. It's quite amazing that we'll put money into the bank at 30 or a pension fund and really see that people collect it, you know, 30 years later. I mean, what a achievement to have that much trust and stability in the financial system. That is actually, you know, a really amazing. But there is a problem. I want to do a whole scan, an anthropological scan of financial advisors, is that they think people want to leave money to their children or their legacy. And it turns out that's just not true. People, it's so untrue. Now, it's really hard to admit that to a surveyor, but that's not why people are saving. They're usually saving because they don't know how long they're going to live. And it's like not having health insurance means that we all put $25,000 or $250,000 in a shoebox just in case we need a kidney transplant. I mean, that's really crazy. So what if we had longevity insurance, you know, where you could put a little extra in and you would get more Social Security as you grow older and you need more money, or you would have a higher Social Security if you live past 85, people would do that in New York Minute and wouldn't put it in a shoebox or hoard it. Most bequests are accidental. And that's actually sad.
Yeah, market failure.
And it's what you fear. And it also means that we have a totally inefficient retirement system. Most inheritance that people get, and most people don't get anything, and the average inheritance is $50,000, is an accident. Your mother left you a house that was worth $500,000, and if she only knew, she would have spent that. She would have spent it, you know, and not on you. You know, she would have had a lot more fun.
So that's my question. Let's say, Teresa, and this is, you know, we can ask this question in a bunch of different ways, but let's ask it from the point of view of someone who's 65, maybe 70 years old, who's just retired, who has $4 million, and they're like, I want to die with nothing.
Yeah.
My email is slate money.
How much is too much? Like, I don't want to, I don't want to die. I don't want to reach nothing before I die, because then I'll be left with nothing and I'll be broke, and I don't want that. But like, there has always been this sort of actuarial rule of thumb that you should spend down about 4% a year. And that actuarial rule of thumb predates this like new secular low interest environment. And I've seen people say that that should not be 4% anymore. It should be more like 2.5%. How much of that money can I spend if I have no desire to pass anything on to my kids?
Yeah. So I've written about this. Everybody's written about it. And it ranges from 2.5 to 3.18. You know, it's lower. The point is it's lower than 4%. So that's a good problem. You just have to decide whether it's 2.5. And if you take out less, then the chances that you'll leave something behind that you don't want to goes up. And if you spend a little bit more, the chances are that you're going to run out of money goes up. So you just have to titrate it. But the number, you should not anchor it at 4. Anchor it at 3 and you'll be about right. But the big problem is like your house. We have this weird system where people are asked to buy their house. In Germany, only half the people, they live in nice houses, own their house. Most of it is regulated rent control. And the builders, you know, build it with that intent that they're going to regulate it. In New York City, most people, middle-class people, live in rent. So in America, buying your house is really pretty peculiar. And it doesn't really match an aging society. One of our biggest problems is that we have big mismatch between the kinds of housing that we have and the kinds of households we have. So if you go to Kansas City and you go to the suburbs, you have a lot of old ladies rattling around a 3-bedroom, 2-bath ranch that they have no reason to have. It might be left over when she dies and it's extra hundreds of thousands of dollars she could have spent. So we have an inefficient system, not only because of retail, you know, mutual funds available to the likes of us and the wholesale well-managed funds available to the likes of the rich. But we also have a wealth accumulation process that relies way too much on the house. So if you want to not, if you don't have anybody you want to leave money to, maybe you've given enough money to your kids during their whole life and having a bequest is not a goal. Then you also have to do something about your house. But right now, what something called a reverse mortgage is not
it's
a very
bad news.
Yeah, exactly. It's not
wait,
a good
wait,
product.
Are they bad? I thought the reverse mortgage is the solution to this problem. Well, how is it not a solution to this problem?
No, always bad.
If you look at Consumers Reports, they will tell you that probably selling your house and going someplace else would be more efficient, you know, because that's the, and then just taking the money.
Yeah, but that involves like going through all the shit in the garage and like, who has time for that?
Yeah, you know, exactly. That could be worth hundreds of thousands. I really think most people are left with the crap from their parents and the money that goes along with it just because no one wants to go through the stuff in the garage. My mother just did die. That was sorry. But right before we had to do it, her obituary was posted and somebody came and robbed it. and after the tears
oh
and all
God,
that, we were kind
Dad.
Of, oh, I have this left. They didn't take this. But, you know, if they had, I'd be better.
What is it?
Because none of you can see this, but Teresa's holding up. It's like
Teresa,
a clock.
What are you showing us here? Is that a carriage clock?
It's a clock. It's really heavy clock. It might be worth $100, maybe. But they took a lot of this stuff.
That's awful.
Yeah, it was awful, but it really did help my weekend, the next weekend. It was pretty awful.
this is the darkest episode ever of Slate Money.
Just hire someone to rob you. Then you don't need to worry about moving your stuff. So then you can move to a smaller place, and then you can free up hundreds of thousands of dollars that you have in your house, which you can use to take your kids out for lovely restaurant meals. I mean, it all makes sense.
This episode has been a tiny bit heteronormative, so I want to ask a couple more questions. One of the stories that I was reading recently is about, you know, the elder millennials of a generation to which I belong, realizing that they have no inheritance, they don't necessarily have kids, they're not necessarily married, and perhaps do not have 401ks, but are trying to do like the one thing, to your earlier point, that can help get them on the ladder, which is like they want to buy a house. So they're trying to pool assets with other folks, but there's no kind of good legal mechanism or recognition for these kinds of relationships. You know, you have same-sex marriage being mostly legal in the United States, though who knows what's legal about for anything anymore and for how long. And again, for a long time, you know, folks who were outside of the conventions of whatever we defined as the status quo were locked out of these kinds of benefits. You've talked about Vanguard being kind of a good idea for people, but what is the advice for folks who don't even have the scraps of access to getting on these types of ladder?
Yeah, no, right? I mean, so I work with my colleague, Derek Hamilton, who is a fan of baby bonds. And that's the whole idea, is that you have to have a system of accumulation. We had that idea that we would equalize wealth processes with Pell Grants and low-cost public education. That, you know, it was the human capital that everyone was supposed to be able to get advantage of. And then that was really harmed by student loans. That was just replaced by debt instead of grants. So we need to actually change the human capital accumulation to be cheaper and more available and get rid of student debt and do it with cheaper healthcare education. And the word I have, the equivalent of Vanguard in the housing wealth process would be co-ops. So that you don't have to provide, you don't have to create a cooperative relationship outside of the, you know, of the traditional marriage, but you provide create a cooperative relationship among a handful of people that you have a close relationship and a legal obligation. So that's a legal form.
But if you live in a co-op, like if you live in a co-op and like you're and something breaks, isn't there just like one person that you get to call, as opposed to like every time something breaks, it's like, well, who are we going to call? I don't know. And that just seems like a bad thing when I'm old and retired to have to deal with all the different things breaking all the time.
So owning a home has a lot of costs to it that nobody ever takes into account. And that's these maintenance costs and headache costs and risk costs. So that's about 4% of the purchase price of the home. Add in property taxes, and you have a pretty close to a rent equivalent. Take a co-op form, and that you're like shareholders, you know, in a big building. And so your neighbor owns your toilet. And if your toilet breaks, your neighbor has this cooperative relationship that the super comes in and fixes your toilet because they don't want your toilet to run or be broken. That's as good as it gets. That's as good as it gets. And it's really important for older people. We're now, the union for doormen are now training their doormen how to do some elder care and to watch for elder abuse so that you actually have a professionals there to kind of watch for who's going up there, whether or not Catherine, you know, has come out of her apartment. So that's what a family does. That's what couples do. You know, it's not based on sort of a sexual relationship, but it's completely cooperative and self-caring outside of a, you know, heteronormative couple relationship. And I am really looking forward to the foundation or to the academic, you know, or to Mayor Pete, you know, somebody like that, some leader, you know, who will try to create these organizations. The Jewish Home for the Aged is actually a really progressive way to think about aging and living in cooperation. That's not that Kansas City suburb.
We are running a little bit long, and I do want to make sure that we include a nod to your big proposal that you have going on with Kevin Hassett, specifically And just to be, just to flesh it out a tiny bit more than you have already, the idea is that the federal government has a really good pension plan and people pay into it. And there's no reason why normal Americans shouldn't be able to pay into the same pension plan that members of Congress get. And it's your money. It's not like it's even necessarily subsidized by the government. But if you just had access to that plan, the outcomes would be fantastic.
We propose a very simple plan that everybody has access to what the federal government have. This makes sense. It's called the Thrift Savings Plan. That's the federal government's pension plan. And that's what members of Congress are in. That's what the that's what their workers are in. And that's what everybody who work for the federal government across the country are in. So there's a member of this pension plan every in your neighborhood. And the idea is that we could, as Americans, since it's actually run by the American government, could have access to this platform. The platform is efficient. It's the one that you want to be in because of the fees and the information and the way it's handled. And it also goes with you no matter what kind of work you're in. Self-employment one day, a part-time employee another year, a full-time employee another year. It's always with you. It's as efficient as having one Social Security account. You have one pension account. So I can't stress how important just that simplicity, you know, would matter to people, that they could see their savings grow. They would get encouraged by it. They would know what it would mean for their retirement. But a lot of people want more than just the simplicity. They also need the money. And so if you're earning below the median wage, which is around $55,000 per year, the government would provide the contribution. The employer wouldn't have to. They could if they wanted to, but the employer would give you that $600 to $1,000, depending upon how much you made every year. And you would add at least 1%, but you could go up, you could go much higher. So it comes from what we found in behavioral finance is that people have a match. They will readily involve themselves in the wealth accumulation plan. If they can see it grow, they will be encouraged to plan more. And if they trust the administration, they will even keep the money in. So it is actually the best ever idea I've had in a 35 years of ideas. That we just, it's like Medicare for all. We've all heard of this idea that you have a Medicare. This would be just a thrift savings plan for all. It's already there and it can take in, it can take in the 63 million or even more Americans that don't have anything now.
Teresa, thank you so much. It's been absolutely amazing having you on the show.
I'm glad.
And thanks for listening. Thanks to Shana Roth for producing. And we will be back next week with another Slate Money.